Game Bros.
Hello, listeners.
Hey, everybody.
It's finally another episode of the Board Game Brothers podcast. I'm Jeffrey Craig.
And I'm Matthew Craig.
We're brothers in real life.
And game designers in real life.
And this is our podcast where we talk about board games. And it's been a couple weeks since we've put out an episode. And we apologize for that. But, the main reason that we haven't done it is because this is actually our 100th recorded episode in our podcast's history.
Yeah, it's a big milestone for us.
Yeah. Now, our episodes are numbered slightly differently than that because it's number 100 overall. That also counts the Good Stuffs episodes that we used to do at the beginning of our podcast. And I think there may have been a couple other odd episodes here and there. But so in the mainline series of podcast episodes, it's not 100, but this is our 100th recorded episode, and we had to celebrate the milestone in some kind of special way. And so it took a while to think of an idea of what to do, and by the time we settled on one, the holidays were upon us, and we were busy with those. So finally, 3 weeks now since our last episode, we have found the time, and we are ready to record and put out this very special episode for you guys.
Yes.
So, Matthew, what theme did we decide on for this episode?
So this is a fitting theme for this time of the decade because we're talking about the best board games, in our opinion, of the 2010s, or at least our favorite board games of the 2010s.
Mm-hmm. Favorite is probably the more applicable term.
The better descriptor here.
Best, in our opinion, kind of works. But yeah, you may have seen lists on other websites about, you know, the top X board games of the decade, or maybe the top X like songs and albums and stuff, movies. But so we're inspired by all of those to put out this episode and talk about our favorite games of the last 10 years that we have played.
Right.
And it's been a long 10 years, hasn't it?
Oh, right. Yeah. When you think about it, like the 2010s or the start of the 2010s was really when board games started to become as big as they are now.
Mm-hmm.
And like, you know, so a lot of like the major advancements in board games have happened in the last 10 years.
Sure. Although I was surprised to find out that Betrayal, the original Betrayal at the House on the Hill, was published in 2007.
Oh, right. Yeah.
So there were some really amazing games that were published in the 2000s. But yeah, I agree that things really kicked off in this decade, and we have seen some very incredible games released since the start of this decade. So we have each created a list of our top five games, and I think there's only one overlap, so we're gonna have 9 games to discuss collectively, our favorites of the 2010s. So I guess we'll just start at the bottom and start discussing them. So I'll let you go first, Matthew. What is your fifth favorite game of the decade?
My fifth favorite game is Root, which was designed by Cole Werrell. And Root is that asymmetric game, like with sort of storybook artwork. But I think the thing about Root that really gets me is how smooth the asymmetric play is incorporated. Because, like, I mean, when I think about major advancements in board gamings, it's asymmetric play has been really explored this decade to a much greater extent. And by asymmetric play, I mean where not only do different players have different starts and like initial states, but they have unique actions, unique goals.
Mm-hmm. Unique ways to play the game.
Right, yeah.
So I want to touch on something real quick. Is your list based on advancements in board gaming, or is that just the theme for why this game is on the list?
So I didn't want to overlap like genres too much. These are all games where, like, when I'm thinking about playing a board game, these are games that come to mind first thing. You know, these are games that I enjoy playing first off, but like also I did want to kind of touch on big changes or important games per se from my perspective.
Okay, so you would say that, like, in the rankings of all board games that you played, you sort of separated them by your play experience and then also by importance to board game design as a whole. And
right.
That's kind of how you arranged your list. And then you tried not to have repeat like genres.
Right. I'd say 80% of it is just play experience. 20% of it is the meta stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Okay. And so Root's on here because you enjoyed playing it, obviously. And
right.
Then it also did bring this asymmetric game. There were other asymmetric games before it. I mean, the publisher, Leader Games, put out Vast Crystal Caverns like a couple years before that, maybe
right.
even the year before
that. It was the same designer, Cole Werrell.
Same designer.
Sure. And you can tell that
Root stands out.
Right. You can tell that they learned their lessons from Vast when he designed Root, because Root, it does enough where like certain aspects are shared between players, but those resources are used completely differently. Also, a big theme along this list of mine is Root does a great job at sort of displaying the flavor of the game through the mechanics, like with the birds that swoop really high and then fall down, or Vagabond, the Wanderer,
mm-hmm,
sort of Vagabond. Character that is mostly by themselves and they only have the one unit that they actually use, giving you more of a sense of loneliness. Yeah. And like I said at the start, the art is also fantastic. This isn't always a big thing for me, but Kyle Farron's art is phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to give props to that every chance I get.
Absolutely. I think as far as the design goes, the point that you made that it's an asymmetric game where players have different ways of interacting with the game's pieces, but a lot of the game's pieces, especially those cards in Root, are shared between every player, and they use them in similar ways, but not entirely similar ways. And that makes for a whole lot of comprehension, you know, assistance for each player, either switching between roles or just trying to understand what their opponents do in the game.
Right, yeah, because, you know, asymmetric games can have the problem of, like, it's hard to tell what the opponent's doing if you haven't learned their faction or whatever. But Root does it really well because, like you said, they share certain mechanics, or, like, certain conflict resolution is the same between every faction. You know, the way it determines who owns what territories or how you can move around them. So it's just enough that everybody can interact on the same axis without too much issue. But it's, you know, they're still unique in how they play out everything else.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Anything else to say about Root?
Nope.
All right. That is Matthew's number five, Root. So my number five is a game that you and I had some disagreements on, but I'm very fond of it, and that's Champions of Midgard.
Okay.
So I would say I base mine a little more heavily weighted, even more heavily weighted than you, on play experience. And I've had a great deal of fun playing Champions of Midgard. It is a worker placement game. It is a push-your-luck combat game with dice. It's about creating bands of Viking warriors who have to go on adventures to defeat monsters and bring glory to the name of the Viking leaders to determine who becomes the next Jarl. I think, first of all, it's a pretty seamless like integration of a new mechanic into an existing genre of game, in my opinion. This combat, adding it into a worker placement game. And I think one thing that the game does well is that the workers are like way more important and active than in other worker placement games. Like usually in a worker placement game, you place your worker somewhere and they're either gaining a resource or they're spending a resource. And in Champions of Midgard, the workers do way more than that. Like some workers will manage your inventory. Like they can shuffle around like the kinds of resources that you have to get what you need. Certain workers will go on adventures, or they'll stake a claim in an adventure or a monster that you want to defeat. So I think it adds a little more interest to the worker placement genre. I think it's a pretty solid game overall.
Mm-hmm.
It has a little bit of immersion to it that not a lot of board games can achieve, where and I feel it the most whenever I go on the adventure, like when you have to take a boat to go fight a monster. And so you have to like either have to have built a boat yourself, or you can rent a boat from the game, and you set your worker down at the southern edge of the board. You set a boat down there, and then you designate a number of warrior dice and a number of food tokens that are being stored on that ship. And you like flip a card to cross the ocean, and that card could present some kind of challenge. And then you get to the other end of the journey and you fight a monster. That's usually a very difficult fight. And just that whole process of like selecting my men and my stores and sending them off without knowing exactly how the trip's going to go, and then overcoming that challenge in the end and getting a ton of points as a reward, is a very like gratifying feeling, but it's also like pretty immersive,
right?
As far as board games go,
I think Champions of Midgard has one of the best board layouts of any game I've played, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
The main board that everything happens on is just like very, it does a good job of using like flow to illustrate things, like how for the most part everything is ordered from top to bottom in order of importance,
or rather center to edge,
right? But like the ogres or whatever that you fight that give you points and add blame to the opponents is near like the top of the board.
Oh, wait. I see what you're saying, top to bottom importance, but then center to edge flow.
Yeah,
like when you play the game, you should put your workers in the center of the board first and then on the edges of the board later when you're ready.
Right.
But then, yeah, I get what you're saying, that you want to go from top to bottom, like, right, when you're strategizing.
Yeah.
Thinking,
so
what's the most important action to take?
Right. So it's like
the
center is where all of the different actions are, and they're kind of clustered together, but they all focus on the action in the middle, which is to get a new worker or take first player. But then like the ones towards the top edge are also very important, like hunting for food. And then you kind of scan downwards when in terms of points until you find the like monsters and the voyage and stuff. It's very clean in terms of where you're looking, and the order things go in the game is the order they're presented on the board.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, just saying, you have to venture to the southern edge of the board to go fight, you know, these dangerous overseas monsters. You know, that's a fun image that,
yeah,
not a lot of games go for. The artwork's good. It was designed, by the way, Champions of Midgard was published in 2015. It was designed by Ole Steinis, and the artist Victor Perez Corbella also did a very good job illustrating these very fun, like almost comic booky, but also very detailed illustrations of Vikings and monsters and warriors and stuff.
Right.
All right.
Yeah.
Number four. Let's
number
hear your
four.
Number four.
My number four is Millennium Blades, designed by D. Brad Talton Jr. So Millennium Blades, if you're unaware, is a TCG simulator where you're not playing a competitive card game. You're playing a person playing that game. It's a game where you build a deck, you buy singles of cards and buy new packs and open them. You sell off cards to the secondary market. You pay attention to the metagame. You go to tournaments and face off against other players. You get extra points by having accessories like a deck box and sleeves. And so I think one of the big things is D. Brad Talton Jr. is really good at adapting an existing feel or game into a board game. So like Battlecon is another game of his that adapts a fighting game into a board game. And like the strength is really interesting because when I play Millennium Blades, I get what it's trying to convey. Like I get the feeling of really hastily buying up cards for the tournament so you can get that one card you need, or trying to see what gives you the most value that you're okay with parting with. And the actual, like, tournament phase, the resolution where you gain points, has an appropriate level of, like, combo-iness and trying to get good synergy while also just playing to the metagame that it conveys it all really well. And there's a lot of, like, fun physical things because the game is mainly a real-time game where all the gathering and selling cards and all that is done at the same time over a span of, like, 7 minutes. And you use these wads of cash, which is both really funny from, like, you know, oh, this is how much money you spend, but also extremely practical since it's easier to separate wads of cash than, you know, fake money bills. And personally, I'm a big fan of the, like, reference potpourri sort of theme where it just kind of references anything and everything. And I think this game pulls it off pretty well by having individual sets that are all themed around some sort of reference, like westerns or musicians, like famous rockers. And each of the sets in the game has their own theme to go along with it, which is fun. Also, it's interesting because D. Brad Talton Jr. loves to pack, like, a ton of content into his games. And I actually got a chance to play the Millennium Blades co-op version recently, which was a different enough experience that, like, it was the same, sort of, like, I didn't have to learn too much, and it was a similar feel to what I was used to, but it was still, like, you know, different enough that it made me want to play that again, as well as just the regular mode. So, yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
yeah, I have nothing else to weigh in on that. You pretty much covered a lot on that game,
right? Yeah
it's a good game, and I get what you're saying about, like, the whole, like, simulation of the game is very good, the components are very good, the feeling of playing the game is very good. All yeah. right, my number four game of the decade is Super Fight.
Yes, I figured this would be on yours.
Yes. And now Cards Against Humanity was released in 2011, so if you want to talk, like, super influential games, Cards Against Humanity is absolutely at the top of that list, especially in this genre, which is the two deck call and response type of game. I guess really just a two deck game, because Super Fight isn't a call and response game,
right?
Per se. But in this two deck party game, Cards Against Humanity is absolutely, like, the king. It's like the alpha and omega of the genre. But what Super Fight did was, first of all, it didn't have to be adult in order to be an entertaining game. You know, plenty of other games in this genre that have been released since Super Fight, and also released by the designer of this game, Jack Dyer, like, it's kind of lean on the adult themes in order to be appealing to new audiences. But Super Fight didn't need that, and it also didn't need the call and response you know, format. It's just character and ability / you know, equipment are the two types of decks. So what Super Fight did for me, other than just be, like, a very entertaining game that I've played a whole bunch, I've gone through the deck, you know, multiple times. Oh, that's another point to make. But anyways, but other than being very entertaining on the influence side of the game, it showed, at least to me and probably to many other people, that the genre of the two deck party game is not entirely solved. There's a whole lot of design space still available in this genre of game that only has two types of components. So there's that. Now, a couple other points about Super Fight. One of the points that I was just about to make was that like, I've played a ton of Cards Against Humanity as well, and I've been through that deck multiple times just through playing it. I've seen, like, every card multiple times. And after playing that personally so many times, the jokes get stale. But in Super Fight, I guess they're not jokes, so it's not like it has to lose. It's not like it has that kind of an appeal to lose. But, you know, I've played the game multiple times. I've been through it multiple times. And every time there's something interesting to come about. I guess just because the cards are kind of equal, and it's like the combinations can have big implications and stuff like that. So that's one thing about Super Fight. The other thing that I'd like to hear maybe your thoughts on, Matthew, if you have any, is that Super Fight is like a very blank slate of a game. And for some reason, this game more than others has led to us coming up with more ways to play it than just the base way to play it. In fact, I'm pretty sure we hardly ever play it the intended way as the rules describe. Right. We every time we play it, we pretty much play it our own way. So there, it's kind of interesting that this game has led to that kind of interaction with the game.
Yeah. I think part of it is this game is a game where it's not done once you play the cards. Like in other of these two deck party games, it's often you submit two cards together as like your submission, and then you don't really interact with it until the next round. But in Super Fight, you place down your character and their powers or whatever, and then you actually have to talk about who wins and debate over it. And this does cause you to like be more invested in a given round, but it also kind of forces you, or kind of not forces, but helps you think like, you know, how would it play out if this happened? And also things like, we kept running into questions of like, what arena are these characters fighting in? Which led to us just thinking, what if we just said what arena it is?
Yeah, that's a good point. I think it raises questions.
Right.
And so by answering those questions, you kind of come up with new ways of thinking about the game.
Right. But I think like the need to role play the game sort of helps encourage and suggest to players that they can mess around with the rules. Because it's just a character. There's no other like, there's no other details on the cards other than the character and their ability. So it doesn't force you to do anything else.
The game components itself do not illustrate how it ends.
Yeah.
It's like, they're just the start. Every card is a prompt, really.
Exactly.
Unlike in Cards Against Humanity, where half of the cards are prompts and then the other half are responses, and that's like the end of it. You know, maybe you could explain the joke if you want to, but explaining jokes never makes them funnier. But yeah, in this game, the cards are all prompt. Every component is a prompt that you as a person have to work off of. And so there's a lot of space for creativity in this game.
Exactly.
Yeah, so that's why I put Super Fight in my top five as at slot number four. It's just a fun party game that kind of shook up the format and led to some very interesting personal experiences with the game, just from being able to like tweak the rules and bend the rules and use the cards in new ways that I saw fit to make more interesting experiences.
Yep.
All right. So now we get to number three, and this one is the same game for both of us.
Yes.
Matthew, what is our game number three?
Spirit Island, designed by R. Eric Royce. Where to start with Spirit Island? I mean,
so it's a cooperative game.
Yeah.
It's also where each player controls a spirit, and you are protecting an island from colonial invaders. And the way that the game plays out is your spirits at the start of the game have some presence on the island, but you are very weak. And as the game plays out, your spirits grow in strength and you acquire new powers. But so too do the invaders. The invaders are constantly growing and expanding and exploring. So a lot of the game, there's a tension of the struggle between the players and the invaders. And in this game, especially in this game, compared to other cooperative games, that tension is very high and the threat seems very real. And then eventually you're meant to overcome it as a group.
Right. It's like, it's a cooperative game that's also really crunchy. Like there's a lot of mechanics to it. And it's hard to like quarterback because of that. You know, you can only really focus on your corner of the board. So it does a good job of making sure every player is involved in the game and
right.
feels useful.
It's almost impossible to have a perfect understanding of what everybody could do at any given moment in time. really, in this game, the only thing that you can do with your opponents, or with the knowledge of your opponent's actions, you can really only understand like one thing that they can do. Right. And like for example, the lightning character in this game has a card that lets a slow power be used at fast speed. And slow powers in this game, there's two speeds that your abilities or your actions can take place. Either there's fast powers that happens before the invaders do anything, and there's slow powers that happen afterwards. Slow powers are usually more powerful than the fast powers, but the invaders get a chance to, you know, destroy the land and explore further before you get to use them. So they're not as strong as you'd think they would be. So the lightning character has a card that lets you speed up a slow power to a fast power, which is very good. And when I'm playing in a game with the lightning character, I'm pretty much only tracking that card of theirs. Like, right, whatever else they do, that it, you know, they're responsible for it. They have the understanding of it. And I'm just leaving things to them. And I pretty much have to, because if I tried to track anything else that they could do in the game, then I would just lose track of everything. It's too much information. I can only track that one thing, and that's the most useful thing for me. But because of that, I can't like micromanage their turns from turn to turn.
Right. Yeah. Like, since you plan everything at the same time as everybody, you can't really even, you know, look over there. So I find myself asking, "Can you do this?" or "What are you able to do?" more often than other co-op games.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, usually that's actually a pretty big distinction, that in this game you're not telling somebody what they can do. You're almost always asking them, like, what can you do?
Yeah. This game is another good one where all the spirits play sort of like what they're themed at. Like, the lightning does a lot of good damage in bursts and also can speed things up. The water goes kind of, or the ocean waves go in and out, but mainly focus on the ocean. The earth likes to build up in one spot and kind of expand around like a mountain. So it does have that like thematic component mm-hmm. to it.
And speaking of the individual spirits, I think this game is really interesting in that it has like a super like deep capacity for player mastery. And so like when I play a game of Spirit Island as the Earth Spirit, like that, those games go by incredibly quickly and they're incredibly easy, at least in my corner of the board and most likely in other players, because I'm so good and efficient with the Earth Spirit that like my neighbors can feel the effects. And that just comes from, like, I have a deep, like, understanding and mastery of the Earth Spirit. It's my favorite spirit in that game. Another friend of ours only plays the Lightning Spirit. And when it's the two of us, Earth and Lightning, like, the games are always easy. Like, we have to up the difficulty for those.
Right.
And that's not something I could say for lots of other games. It helps that it's a cooperative game, because then it's not like, I don't have, like, a mastery of something that I can use to like defeat other players. And I think that's also probably because like when there's another player, then there's mastery, but there's like ways of, there's like counterplay. In this game, there isn't the counterplay. You just kind of like master something and you dominate with it, which is a fun feeling. I guess what I'm trying to say is it's a cooperative game with like a deep level of mastery, and that mastery is a very satisfying thing to achieve in this game.
It is cool that like there's a couple different axes and each way you can interact with something. Like, you can deal damage to cities, or you can defend that land so that the natives fight back, or mm-hmm. you can blow up cities and towns, or you can generate more fear to make it easier to clear out more settlers. It is also interesting that this game has an anti-colonial theme.
Mm-hmm.
I just think that's interesting when like there's so many games about settling in an unclaimed land. This game is directly opposed to that. Yeah,
exactly. That is a fun like meta point. Mm-hmm. Now, despite what I just said about the mastery of the game, it still feels like, especially when I'm playing like a spirit that I'm less familiar with, it feels like that the threat in this game is very real and very tense, compared to like other cooperative games. That probably has something to do with that it's just a more crunchy and complicated game. You don't really feel that pressure in like Forbidden Island, because it's a pretty simple cooperative game. But on top of that, in addition to that, you know, because there's that threat, it's also incredibly satisfying when you get to the winning position and then you defeat the threat.
Yeah.
It's like the tension is much higher, and the success, the feeling that you get when you succeed, is also much higher in this game.
Oh yeah, for sure. I definitely think part of that's because when you're winning, you start to remove more and more of the buildings, which keeps these plastic pieces off the board. And also with the threat, it's because the blight feels like such a big deal, because you remove one and it feels like you don't have many left to put on the board, or you put a blight onto the board and it removes a presence, and like now your spirit's significantly weakened in dealing with the specific area. So like it does a good job of presenting a threat, making it feel like a big threat, but then also giving you tools to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Number two. All right.
What do you got?
I have Food Chain Magnate, designed by Jeroen Doman and Joris Wersinga. And Food Chain Magnate is just one of the tightest engine builders I've ever played. And I love engine builders. But so it's a game about managing a fast food chain, starting from just one restaurant with one manager and building up your empire from there. But it's not as much about building up as it is like maintaining staff at a level where you're still making a profit, but able to hire good staff, and then like getting into price wars with your opponents, because there's like this system for how the houses on the board determine where they're going to eat. And one of the most efficient ways to deal with that, from, you know, removing the customers of your opponents and making them go to your restaurant, is to undercut your opponents. So it has this like really cutthroat nature to it. It has a really clean and elegant action system, in that the number of employees you can play is based on the number of management slots that your managers have. And your main manager, your CEO, can only manage other managers, or only your CEO can manage other managers. Your other managers can't manage managers. There's a lot of managers there, do you understand? But it's very clean, and like it makes sense from a real world standpoint, and turns that into a interesting method of like gaining more actions and more things you can do every turn. The game, it definitely feels like also cutthroat, in that there are the milestones that you can only get if you're on the first turn anybody gets them. So after the turn where somebody gets one, they're gone. But it also does give you direction early game, which I think is important for an engine builder, to like, you know, at least have something you can focus on early game when you're not sure, you know, if you can reach a given goal. The game also has some fun like spatial elements with where you place your first restaurant, and then how that affects what drinks you can get and what houses go to you, as well as then you start to get into marketing, and marketing has like an area of effect and all the different methods. I used to compare it a lot to StarCraft, which is really just because it's a strategy game where there's a base placement aspect, and you're like developing units and using those units to control the map in some way. But the units in this case produce pizzas and burgers. This game is really difficult if you're not sure, or if you're new to it, which is kind of unfortunate. But I think it's definitely a game where like the more I play it, the more invested I am in learning it. And I don't know, I think that's really neat. It also has this like what, 50s, 60s style like illustration design.
It's reminiscent of like Monopoly,
right? Yeah,
but also like, you know, the illustrations you'd see in like diners,
yeah,
on, like, menus and stuff.
Exactly. It has this old-timey feel to it that just adds to the aesthetic. I don't have much else to say on it other than it's just really tightly designed.
Mm-hmm. All right, so my number two is another worker placement game. It's Lords of Waterdeep.
Ooh, wow.
So I think, so when I think of like what a solid game looks like from front to back, like components, player interaction, like Lords of Waterdeep feels to me like one of the most solid games that I've played this decade. I don't know how else I can really describe, especially like what do I mean by solid. It just seems like I want to interact with the components, and I get like a good feeling every time I do something that the game wants me to do, like completing quests or, you know, just acquiring a lot of resources. I think like every time you play the game, you end up having a good experience with the game. It seems like there's not a lot of disparities that happen in the game. You're kind of always doing something at least, and you're still like always achieving goals. A big thing that I've seen other designers comment on this game and why it's so good is that it's a good game that's based on an IP, which, you know, maybe not until then, and maybe even not often after then, there weren't a lot of games based on IPs that ended up being solid games just to begin with. So it has that going for it.
Right.
I don't know. It's just a solid worker placement game. It's pretty simple. The theming is good. It's hard. I don't know. It's kind of hard to explain. I just really enjoy playing Lord. And every time I play it with people who haven't played it before, they also really enjoy it. It's like a great first worker placement game. It's easy to achieve your goals in this game. Like if people are taking the things that you need on the map, you know, you have other ways of obtaining points and resources, and you also, you know, have the obvious methods of taking first player and taking the things you need.
Right.
Yeah.
This is another game where the game flow is very clear. Like, mm-hmm. how what you do from turn A to turn B to get points, you know. You get adventures and you send them on quests. It's very... It makes sense, especially to people who aren't familiar with any sort of gaming in any way.
Mm-hmm. By the way, this was designed by Peter Lee and Rodney Thompson.
Right. I think basically, yeah, it's like there's not many bad points to the game. And it's really enjoyable when you're able to get a whole bunch of adventures and then send them for a huge reward.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I think
all of the components kind of like just make sense together in this game too. Like they have the lords themselves, they have the quests, they have the units or the cubes that you collect to go on the quests. I guess they're just called units or something, adventurers. You have your workers, you have the buildings that you can add to the city. And then you have like the action cards, whatever they're called. I can't remember what they're called. Event cards?
Intrigue? Something
intrigue
like that?
Cards. Yeah, intrigue is right. But like every, like some of the intrigue cards are formatted just like quests, but they're obviously worse. So there's like an instant recognition of what they do. The other intrigue cards, just perform very unique actions, and you know, you can just assume that, and those actions always just involve like acquiring cubes in different means, maybe from stealing them from other players or taking unique turns, like using a building that's already occupied. All of the buildings that you add to the city are like, you can tell that they're kind of strictly better versions of other buildings, or they're also adding some unique action. The base buildings in the game don't have an upkeep like aspect to them, like some buildings do in other worker placement games, where you're like constantly adding something to the board until someone takes the whole pile, which is great. It makes the game very smooth to play, but some of the buildings, because that is kind of like an integral, like an important part of worker placement, that concept of this like building supply that somebody eventually can take, those are in the buildings that you add to the city. So it's like they take the more annoying upkeep actions, and they make them optional in the game. Yeah, I don't know. It's just a solid game.
Yeah, that's fair to say.
And every time I've played it, I've had a great time. Even if I didn't win, it felt like I was, you know, accomplishing goals, and the folks that I've showed the game to also very much enjoy it just after one playthrough.
Yeah. I never All feel right, like so, I wasted a playthrough.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a very good point. Especially in a competitive game. You want to feel like at least I did something.
Yep.
All right.
All right.
Number one. We have reached the top of our list. So, Matthew, what is the number one game of the decade for you?
So, the number one game of the decade for me is Betrayal Legacy. And two disclaimers. One, technically we have two sessions left out of, like, what, 15, 11? Something between those?
It's probably 13.
13. And two, I'm going to try to keep this as spoiler-free as possible.
Okay.
Yeah. So, Betrayal Legacy is, for one thing, legacy games are, like, a strictly 2010s and onward thing. Like, you know, who would think to destroy a game component as part of the game? You know, it's kind of before Risk Legacy, it was kind of a understood thing, like silently agreed upon, that, you know, a game can be replayed indefinitely, you know, as long as the components are still physically intact, you know. But legacy games do away with that and use, like, the advantages provided for that to tell a story or, you know, accentuate the game in some way, make it personalized. Betrayal Legacy has some of the best thematic to mechanic connection of any game, especially because a lot of the haunts... Oh, sorry, Betrayal Legacy was designed by Rob DeVoe, Noah Cohen, Ryan Miller, Brian Neff, Andrew Veen, and J.R. Honeycutt. A lot of the haunts in the game, like, encourage you to roleplay out a scenario a certain way, or uses the limited information that the two separate books, The Secrets of Survival and Traitor's Tome, it uses that information that some of them have hidden to others to its advantage to present, like, a unique gameplay, you know, experience. And these are things that could really only work once, because once you've played through it, you know what the twist is for any given haunt or any given scenario. But it's okay with that because it's a legacy game. And so, you know, the aspect of the, like, hidden information is really great. It uses hidden components a great way. There's a lot of cool foreshadowing early in the campaign that appears later. There is a lot of the game that's not explained when you first get the mechanic, and you're kind of expected to make a decision with very limited information. And, like, it's really fun with that because the game is a horror game, or, like, a mystery game, and it plays into that theme by making you make decisions that you're not quite sure whether they're good or bad, or if it'll hurt you in the future, just knowing that for now it's a decision that's presented a specific way. And I think that's just phenomenal, because not often in games do you get to make these huge decisions that feel huge, but you don't know how, you know, don't know what the aspect of it at the end would be, but also, like, make that fun and interesting and not just punishing, you know. It also does have the personalization aspect, like, you can make family heirlooms out of items. By, you know, when you draw an item, you can make it so your family gets bonuses for it, but you get to name the item a specific way, and that mixed with, like, just naming the characters and stuff does give this good element of, like, you are telling the story, you're not just playing a part in it, you're not just an actor, you're a character, you know.
Playing that game, like, has made me develop some very interesting relationships with game components.
Yes. That's one of the greatest things is, like, there are components that you treat like otherworldly items and not just game components. Or, like, you're sad to see certain things disappear and get torn up, almost. Yeah, it's
or you're
it's,
happy to see oh, yeah. them disappear and get torn up.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it feels like there's, I don't know, it just it's very good at giving you reasons to role play and get invested in the game that other games don't really often do. There's also just like rules that are in there that give you a bonus but are fun things to do, which like in fun things to do that aren't just like in game, you know, it's out of game actions that give you a mechanical bonus that encourage you and make it optimal to role play, which is very interesting.
I looked up when Betrayal at House on the Hill was designed for this episode, just because I wanted to put that in this list because it does a good job of like being a role-playing game in board game format. And I couldn't put it on my list because it's not, it was designed last decade, but it's still a excellent benefit of this game in that it takes like a lot of the very fun, enjoyable, immersive things that role-playing games offer, and then it makes you do them, you know, sometimes mechanically, sometimes just for fun in this game, to enhance the play experience. And it, overall, it gets you sometimes more immersed, or sometimes it just makes for fun stories and fun playthroughs of the game.
Yeah.
Like the Whispering Room.
Oh, yeah.
In this game.
Yeah, that's...
Not a huge spoiler, just to say that there's a room in this game where if your character's in it, you have to whisper in real life.
It's there's a whole bunch of stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's great.
All right. And now for my number one game of the decade. It was released in 2018.
Mm-hmm.
It was designed by Hal Duncan and Ruth Vevers. And that game is Cryptid.
Oh, wow. Nice.
Cryptid is my number one game of the decade. For many reasons. First of all, Cryptid, like the design of Cryptid baffles me. just because, so the way that Cryptid works is it's a competitive deduction game where each player is sat in front of a map. The map has many features on it, and it's a hexagonal map. There's many hexagons that have different types of terrains or different geological features to them, and each player is given a clue of where a cryptid could be based on the features of the map. And if one player were to know each other player's clues, then only one space on the map would suit all of those clues or satisfy all of those rules. And so the goal of the game is to discern what all of the other player's clues are so that you can guess where the cryptid is first. The first to find the correct space that the cryptid is hiding wins. So what baffles me about this game is that, so all of the components are kind of modular. There's like six map boards that have a number of hexagons to them. And then there's a couple features that can be shuffled around, these like standing stones and campsites. There's three of each in different colors. And they made an app. Like, the game comes with a deck of cards that tells you how to set up a map and what clues to give every player so that they can play the game. But the game comes with like a web app that you can use to play the game. And the web app can set up the map in one way and give you different combinations of clues for different numbers of players, like anywhere from 3 to 5 players, any combination of clues on the same map, and come up with different places where that cryptid could hide.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's crazy to me that a game like that could exist, and that the algorithm for generating these combinations of clues is so like, you know, is so detailed, or it's just designed in such a way that like, you don't have to change the board or the things on it. And the cryptid could still be anywhere on that map, and the game could come up with like any combination, as far as I can tell, any combination of 3 to 5 clues. And even like difference between 3 to 5 clues, like if it's a 5-clue game, it's not like you could still figure it out with 3 clues. You still need to know all 5 clues to figure out where the cryptid is. So design wise, this game is insane to me. And so I have a great deal of appreciation for it because of that. But as far as play experience goes, which I value much higher than the design in my rankings, this game gives me a crazy feeling or this feeling that I have, like, it's hard to describe. It's probably fueled by some sort of like narcissism that I have, but just the sensation of winning this game feels way better than any other. Like, when I win at this game, it feels way better than when I win at any other game, just because there's a thing that we do, and that's when you win, you get to point to every other player and tell them what their clue was. You get to like out them, what the clue they had was, and like, I don't know, you feel like Sherlock Holmes when you do it.
I think that's the best way to describe it. You feel like a extreme detective who just solved the world's hardest puzzle.
Mm-hmm. It's such a fun game that gives me a really amazing sensation playing it. Even when I don't win at it, it's still fun. You know, there's at least in this game, you're constantly doing something, which is another good point to the design, is that like, even though it's turn-based, like each person takes a turn making their guesses, or making their inquiries, like when it's not your turn, you still have like all that time to look at what is on the board and determine and see if you can figure out what someone's clue might be.
Right.
You know, while you wait.
And every turn adds information that you can use, even if it's somebody else's guess and they guess something, you can still use that information to your advantage.
Right. What you're thinking about, it's not like it's the same thing until it comes back to you. Like, you have to just keep this thought on your mind until it comes back to you. Like, after every person's turn, the game changes and you have something new to consider.
There's this very real...
You're constantly mentally engaged with this game.
Yeah. As everybody starts to narrow down where it can be, there's this very real feeling of like an actual race to get to that one spot, you know? To eke out your own knowledge and advantage and use that to get it first. You know, it feels like everybody's just kind of starting to dash towards that convergence.
Mm-hmm. And this might just be me personally, but I enjoy this sort of like mental ramping that this game has, as opposed to like a physical ramping. Like, for example, a resource management game or an engine builder game has like physical ramping where you're acquiring more and more and more pieces in front of you, and then you spend them all and you win. This is like a mental ramping game where all of the things that you're acquiring and accumulating and building upon to reach the victory is all like intangible.
Yeah, but it's all like knowledge and information. Mm-hmm. And you still feel like you've made a huge leap when you even get one person's clue right.
Personally, I prefer that to the physical ramping. I do like appreciate certain, you know, aspects of games where it's about like acquiring a lot and holding a lot of things in your hands can be very fun. But I feel way more satisfied when I'm just like acquiring hints and clues and I'm piecing things together in my brain. And certainly spending that knowledge is way more fun than, to me personally, than spending a whole lot of resources to buy something very impressive in a game.
Right. I think, you know, while this game is very great for the play reasons that we described, it does also give an interesting window into the future of like AI-based game design, as in like it incorporates this algorithm of setting up the board to its advantage.
Right.
And, you know, and to make more board layouts than a human could possibly come up with.
The only way that I could think that this game could have been made was that it, like, not only were the layouts of how you like assemble the pieces were determined by some sort of algorithm or AI or program or whatever, but the components themselves may have also been designed in such a way, you know, by a computer or an algorithm, so that they can be arranged in any number of ways to obtain, you know, these setups.
Right.
That's the only way I can think to do it. It's magic otherwise.
Yes. It's definitely a sight to behold.
Yeah. So the game impresses me, and it makes me feel like Sherlock Holmes when I win at it. And so for that reason, I have Cryptid as my number one game of the decade.
Yes.
And with that completes our episode on our top five favorite games of the decade.
Do you want to run that back really quick, just saying what the games were?
Sure. Let's hear yours first.
All right. Mine was Root, Millennium Blades, Spirit Island, Food Chain Magnate, and Betrayal Legacy.
All right. And mine, of course, was Champions of Midgard, Super Fight, Spirit Island, Lords of Waterdeep, and Cryptid.
Yes.
All right. So now with the end of the episode, we appreciate you listening. We have an announcement. Now, this has kind of been the case for the last month or two.
Yeah.
The short of it is that we are going to go down to bi-weekly episodes. So every other week we're going to record and put out an episode in our mainline series, which is either reviewing one particular board game or reviewing some sort of concept in board gaming.
Right.
Like a genre or a mechanic or a component.
Right, yeah. It's gotten to the point where, for one thing, it's been increasingly difficult to schedule time to play the game every week and, you know, record as well as play other games that we've wanted to play more often.
Mm-hmm. Additionally, yeah, I mean, for example, like we it's taken us over a year to finish Betrayal Legacy.
Almost
just
a
because
year.
Like we really only meet like once a year to
once a week.
We only really meet once a week to play a game, and most of the time we have to spend that day playing the game that we're about to discuss because we want to play it, you know, as many times as we can and get a good idea of what
right,
it's about.
Yeah. This also gives us more time to really get to know the strategy and the design of whatever game we decide to review.
Right. Another reason why we're going down to bi-weekly is we're also kind of reaching the limits of our collections personally.
Yeah.
We've been, luckily we have a very good local game store. We'll just give them a shout out. They are Miniature Market, and locally in St. Louis they have a library of board games. You can go there, spend $5 and check out board games from their library and play them. And we've been using that to play a lot of the games that we don't have in our collections, but we've been having to use it more and more as the weeks go on because we're running out of games, at least games that we own that we want to talk about.
Yeah.
We could just start scraping the bottom of the barrel and start getting into like some of our like games that we got for free for like attending conventions. But so there's a couple reasons why we're doing this, but overall what it's going to end up doing is it's going to go back to being more consistent for one, since we're not trying to hit like a deadline every week and kind of scrambling. And it's also going to make it more regular since it's not like we'll finally find the time to record on a Sunday and then put out the episode like on Monday.
Yeah.
You know, hopefully because we have this 2-week buffer, we can plan further ahead. We can record further ahead and have these episodes out more regularly scheduled on Saturday.
Right.
You know, we call them a regularly scheduled weekly episode, but,
you know,
now it's going to be the regularly scheduled bi-weekly episode. And hopefully this time it'll actually be regularly scheduled.
Yeah.
So we're going down to bi-weekly episodes. We appreciate you listening every week when you do. And we appreciate you listening to this episode. Just to quickly go into our end of episode plugs, you can follow us on any podcasting platform. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at BG Bros Cast. You can hit us up with comments and suggestions for things that we should check out there. We check out everything that is suggested to us, and now we'll have even more time to check it out and give it a fair shake. We have our website, bgbroscast.com, and that's where you can go. Oh, sorry. It's bgbroscast on Facebook and Twitter. bgbcast.com is our website.
Yeah.
You can find our episodes tagged with the games that we discuss. So if you want to hear our thoughts on all of the games that we just talked about in greater detail, you can find the episodes for those. They're all games that we've discussed on our podcast, and they're on our website tagged. So you just dig through those and you'll find them. Let's see. You can find a link to our TeePublic store on our website. That's teepublic.com/user/BGBcast. Perfect for the holidays. Get a t-shirt of your friend's favorite podcast logo on it. So check that out. And that does it for Board Game Bros plugs. So let's hear it from Matt plugs.
I write articles on the BGBcast website under the episodes and articles tab. My most recent article, I believe, is still the one about Untitled Goose Game. I'm working on a much longer essay about games that I've played in 2019. But in the meanwhile, you can read those writings on that website. It's also under the Matt column tag. And I post updates about when I upload new ones on my Twitter, at Matt Craig Gaming. And I haven't been able to stream that much recently due to outside issues, but if you're interested in seeing updates from when I go live for streaming as well, that would also be on that Twitter, as well as a Discord page that you can find through the description of my Twitch channel, which is twitch.tv/twack. So if I ever am able to get around to streaming sometime soon, that'll be twitch.tv/twak. So yeah.
All right. That does it for Matt Plugs, and that does it for the end of our top five games of the decade episode. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.